Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast with compelling science fiction reasons to stand around watching while your house burns down. I'm Nathan.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Pete.
I'm Conrad.
Well, we're 40 million miles away from home. Some of us are starting to get upsettingly moist, and it looks like only Doctor Who can save us now. So while we wait for him to get round to that, let's discuss the second Doctor Who special of 2009, The Waters of Mars.
I just want to start off this story by saying that these specials are a personal affront to me personally, because the year I moved to the bloody UK is the first year we don't have a season of Doctor Who.
Oh.
Yeah, and 7 months. It's been 7 months since the last episode. That's the longest it's ever been since the hiatus. It's painful. Anguish.
Yeah. We talked last time, I think, about how we felt like we were promised a sort of fuller season of specials than we eventually got. Is that right? Does anyone else remember that? We were talking out, you know, in complete ignorance last time.
I remember reading that we nearly didn't get this one because of the financial crash, Woolworths stopping selling CD singles and then going bankrupt, and so To Entertain not being able to get extra money from Woolworths to top up the Doctor Who budget, like they have been doing, apparently, for like a few years running along. So that, yeah, the collapse of the CD singles market nearly lost us another episode of Doctor Who. We nearly had Sharda part two, and that by now we'd be getting it re-released with puppets and things instead. But it made it. They made it somehow.
What is that mysterious dripping sound?
So is this the best Mars-based special of the 2009 series?
I think it might be. Yeah, I think it's got the edge. Yeah. Actually, generally, this is the one people, if you have a conversation with people generally, you talk about the year of specials and everyone goes, oh, yeah, Waters of Mars was great. And it does seem to come up as the champion of it. Was that accurate?
Yeah, I remember at the time, it's funny, at the time I was dating a non-Doctor Who fan. And I think I tried to show him Ark in Space, because I was going to show him Curse of Fenric, actually. And he was German, and like a week before I was going to show him Curse of Fenric, he got really annoyed with how obsessed with World War II British media was. So I'm like, oh, okay, not that one. So I showed him Ark in Space instead, and he wasn't terribly impressed, but he was impressed by Waters of Mars. He's like, oh, you know, that was serious and good drama and nice dilemma and da da da. I said, do you want to watch it Christmas? No.
you did say that, and not it'll all be over by Christmas. You didn't say that because that would be less good.
And Nathan, can you go back and edit where we all gasped and tutted when Brendan said he was dating a non-fan?
Yeah,
that'll sound really judgmental of us.
Outrageous. That's why most of the season was pulled when we heard, so you know, you were dating somebody who wasn't into it. We were like, no, you can't have him coming over here and taking our season. Our precious Doctor Who, we rationed it. We're going totally against the international flavour of Waters of Mars.
Well, that is actually super striking this time. It is that sort of Troughton-era, moon-based style, sort of international team of people only with ladies.
Yeah. Well, you know, Wheel in Space had Tanya Lernov and Gemma Corwin and Donald Sumpter in a tanning booth. Except, you know,
with one exception, this time they're not doing the accents. When I first watched it, I was like, oh, what is it with this problem that Doctor Who has at the moment? Whenever there's a young Americans in it, their accents are completely unconvincing. And then I go and Google them, and half the time it turns out they actually are American. And that really blew my mind, because I thought, I spent the whole of this watching it thinking, that accent that Roman's doing, he's not really American. Why couldn't they get a proper American? And then it turns out, yeah, he's from Michigan. I know nothing.
Yuri's accent seems to be genuine. Peter O'Brien, as we know from Neighbours in the late 80s.
Yeah. I have to say, on this rewatch, he's a lot less hot in this than I did think in 2009. And part of it is because for about the first half of the episode, it looks like he's wearing a really bad toupee. But it's like, no, that's just his hair.
No, that's his real hair.
Are they still getting to grips with HD and clothes and makeup? It is a bit brutal sometimes. David Tennant's got a sort of blue glow in some scenes that seems to actually be coming out of his skin rather than the lighting.
I think Steffi drops the accent at some point. there's at least one sort of line that she shouts across the main room to the doctor, and it's super kind of posh. It's not...
Yeah, well, I didn't realise until I was reading my Doctor Who The Complete History afterwards that she's meant to be German.
Same here. I straight up thought she was Swedish or Danish.
I think the actress is German, so maybe they were asking her to pitch it. A bit less German, love, no, but a bit more German.
It could be like that situation with the Terminator, where Arnold Schwarzenegger offered to dub the Terminator himself in German.
Ah.
For the German market. And the German distributor says, no, he's Austrian. He sounds like a farmer.
One of the things about this, I think, is that it manages to pull off the trick that The Impossible Planet pulls off by having a cast that you really get to know, I think, quite well. Mm. And not with gimmicks or anything like that, but just with, well... I guess part of the thing is this theme of home and family and children. And so we open, you know, with Adelaide talking to her daughter and the granddaughter, who we will later find is so important, is actually on the call as well. And, you know, we see Yuri talking to his brother on a sort of old recording and stuff like that. And then when Steffi... is about to be hit by the water, she turns on the screen and starts talking to her children. And so just by giving them family relationships, by having all of the characters call each other by their first names, and by sort of delineating relationships among all of the characters really, really quickly, I think that this does, you know, the best job since The Impossible Planet of creating a crew that we're inclined to care about. Mm.
Russell T. Davies is great at that, you know, just sketching characters in a passing phone call or a passing comment. He's a genius at that.
There are glorious little tidbits to be found if you pause it on their screen bios. You know, when it flashes up on screen, the date of death, which is a really nice dramatic thing anyway. But if you pause it, you find out amazing things like Mia was the first person to successfully cultivate asparagus in Martian soil on Earth, and that's what got her place there. Every character should have something like that. The Doctor is a... Dr. Tarek is an Olympic medalist, etc., etc.
I reckon Russell's written them.
Actually, it wouldn't surprise me if friend of the podcast Joe Lidster had written them, because he did a lot of the web content for Russell's era.
Right. And it's lovely that in 100 years in the future, the BBC website has reverted nostalgically to a fairly similar template to the one it had in the early 2000s, including a click here for print version button, which I paused it for
too long.
That's
a 3D printer, you see, by 2059. You get to 3D print your own copy of Yuri by just clicking on a simple link.
Perfect. if he can just up his game about the hilarious anecdotes from his brother. Is it of his brother and his husband? And he tells a story, and I'm like, I'm really dying to know. And he tells the most boring story ever. I think it's like, oh, he's always spending money on things. I'm like, oh, okay, work. But you know, that's good though. That is that kind of mundane, you know, everyday chat.
It's also Russell sort of foregoing the chance to do a gag. Like, I can't imagine Stephen Moffat writing a scene like that where there wasn't, like, an incredibly unexpected and hilarious gag. And Russell isn't going for the gag. Yeah. He's just going for a kind of naturalism sort of thing. So, you know.
Yeah. And something that hit a bit different when I was watching that scene this time is you have a Russian man and his husband.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought back and I thought, hold on, you know, the sort of anti-gay crackdown in Russia, I know was happening while I was living in the UK, but looking back in the years leading up to 2009 was when Moscow Pride started to be banned.
Right.
So, you know, Russell saying, look, in 60 years, we've casually got Russian men with husbands, and you know they have money troubles just like any other couple. There's Russell actually wrote the brother's full speech in English and then had it translated into Russian. And it turns out the way that Yuri's brother discovered it was because he was using the brother's account. He's like, hold on, where's this $400 come from? And this $400, oh, it's nothing, it's nothing. No, it's $400 and another and another. And that's apparently what he's saying in the call.
I love the look on Maggie's face as she's lurching up behind him. She deserves all the awards for converted to monster acting that we've got going. She's clearly studied this very well, and she absolutely nails it. And having her eyes not go quite as monstery as the others, it's mentioned as well, I think, that she's a bit more human than the others, so she's able to be a bit more conniving and calculating, whereas the others are more primal. And I love the way she goes for it. Every shot, she's working the camera.
Mm. In earlier versions of the script, she was speaking with the voice of the flood. Right. But as the writing process went along, and this had a very tortured writing process, but as the writing process went along, they're like, actually, no, let's not have them speak at all. Let's have them be completely otherworldly. Let's have them scream, which immediately makes me think of Hemavores. But yeah,
Screamavores.
But yeah, just make them so
aliens that unusual. Live on screams. We've not done that, have we? We've done the opposite. But we've not. Big finish, big finish, big finish. No, that's not how it works. Commission me, commission me, commission me.
Yeah, that's got to have Mel in it. And it's got to be called don't scream. Whatever you do, don't scream. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's the sort of the opposite of Fury from the Deep.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think it's deliberate? There's the line in there. Someone says, don't even drink. And that's a deliberate Blink reference, isn't it?
What do we think of the monsters? We've already talked about Maggie's performance, but we get Andy and Tarek very quickly turned into sort of scary, lumbering monsters. How do we think they work?
It's really interesting. I'm as I always say on any podcast I do, I'm basically in Doctor Who for the monsters. This is what I turn up for, really. And it's interesting. The reason Maggie, they actually had, you know, they wrote in that line of, oh, she's closer to human because she's this, that, and the other. But it was a toning down thing because there's a lot on this story, and it will keep coming up about just toning it down and reining it in, both in terms of the production and the story. And that was one thing that they were really unsure about. And Russell's is like, they're too like zombies. The white eyes are just too freaky. He was actually going to take all the white contacts out, but they'd already shot Andy and Tarek. So they did, but on the close-ups for her, they just decided to remove the white contacts and write a lineup. And they're terrifying.
It did sound like a line that had been written up in order to get rid of contact lenses. Like, yeah. It did sort of sound like that's what they were trying to do.
And they're super effective. And I know initially they were talking CGI, you know, with some sort of like the Abyss, you know, that kind of CGI water tentacle type vibe. And there was talk of like full prosthetics, some sort of water troll or something. So they looked at various options. And I think I think it's really effective. I mean, they're really horrible to look at. I think it's one of those things, it's just very hard for anyone to look at that and not go, just sort of be slightly repulsed. They're terrifying. They're really, really scary. And although they are slightly zombie-like, those boys can run. And, you know, full points to Elsa Burke for getting that run in unison. And they really, it's a really sort of powerful, when you see those runners who are really good at running and it looks like they're just along tracks, you know, their core is just like going in one straight line. They've absolutely got that run. Fantastic. So they move really well. I think they're just super, super effective.
I think, too, that just having water pouring off them all the time and having them wet all the time, you know, it's not easy or straightforward to have sort of wet people and people who are sort of, you know, constantly wet. And so it's really kind of remarkable looking, and it's just super simple. It's a little bit like the way that... You know the H2O scoop in Smith and Jones, where it's just rain falling upwards. It's a very, very sort of simple thing. I just think having them wet and having them just dripping with water and pouring water sort of all the time is, you know, really imaginative and effective as well.
In the grand tradition of Alien, which of course used, and we can say this because it was officially used in a movie, used KY jelly on the alien to make it look really sort of viscous and fluidy. This production, of course, uses hair gel.
Oh, really?
That's how they sort of look sticky and glistening. Hair gel.
Well, that explains Peter O'Brien's hair. Okay, yeah, that's where the shell went. Okay.
And one of the 10th Doctor's greatest weaknesses, of course. But it's not trembling with emotion.
It has to be said, his head does look astonishingly good in this. it does really look good, and I'm not a, yes, it's great.
Andy is played by Alan Rusko, who has been a long time monster performer in the RTD era, all the way back to he was the lead Auton.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of like if you've got a principal monster in these first 4.5 years of new Doctor Who, it's Alan Rusko or Paul Casey,
right?
Pretty much. And one, they knew he'd be able to put up with the prosthetics, but two, they were also like, yeah, let's give him a speaking part, go on.
Well, they're nearing the end. There's not going to be much of a chance.
This does have that real feel of being the last proper normal episode before we go off into mad finale zone, I guess, because this could drop at any point, but that as a story in its own structure. But it's like, yeah, getting a lot of the old gang back and getting Graham Harper to direct, this is his last one, isn't it, so far? I think Russell T. Davis has probably in the back of his mind had a checklist all this time of all the Doctor Who formats he wants to do, and he finally decided to do a proper pure historical, and that's what we've got here. It just happens to be set. It's basically a remake of The Massacre. If you just replace the water with Catholics, and then put sort of David Tennant is being Stephen Taylor, the actual lead character of The Massacre, and yeah, there's not much else. And Adelaide is no. She's not Dodo. Okay, I haven't thought this through entirely, but it's just a bit of a vibe. Because he was never going to do a straightforward base under siege.
you were just talking there. You've just unlocked a memory that's been lurking in my head. I hadn't realised. I was like, this rings a bell. And I remember I went to a Doctor Who convention way back in the day. And I remember there was a car. I was in a car. Sorry, this is me trying to piece together this memory. And in the front, it's sort of show busy. In this car, there was so Nicholas Courtney is in this car. He's not driving the car, but Nick Courtney is in the car. So I'm in a car with Nick Courtney. So this is already a good story. And I'm next to, but also in the car is a girl from, I'm sorry, I don't know her name. She was in Doomsday for a spit in a cough playing. There's a flash to like Tokyo and everyone's crazy about the ghosts or something. And there's a couple of girls all sort of like, schoolgirls all giggling, saying, oh, the ghosts are the latest trend and all that stuff. She was at a convention, not knowing what she was doing there. And I was sat next to Alan Rusko, and we were having this conversation, and he was actually talking about he'd done all these monsters, and he was now just deciding whether it was time to just sort of say no to the monsters and just stick out for an acting part. So I'm really glad he got this. That was a lot. I think he was ushering in a theatre at the time. I'm sorry, this is scraps. This is like tape. This is tape unspooling from a sort of a theatrical riddled brain. So I'm so sorry. That's my story about Alan Rusko. Good evening. Yeah.
You're gazing at a pocket watch as this anecdote comes back to you.
I'm so sorry. Sorry, that was feel free to cut that out, but I have nothing. That's a nug. It's like a sort of showbiz furball I've just coughed up, but there you go. but I'm really, really glad that Alan got a chance to do that on Doctor Who. I think that's brilliant because he was looking at the time to do, because I've written down a list because, as I said, I'm obsessed with monsters. So he played Auton's tree, one of those beautiful trees from End of the World, one of the most beautiful monsters we ever saw. Slitheen, the android, and Trini. So I think maybe he may have been felt up by John Barrowman. So there may be a lawsuit. and a clown in Sarah Jane. And then finally, Andy in the Flood. So good old, well done, Alan. And the monster performers really, they just don't get enough credit. They're just superb. And it must be galling to be on the screen all that time and hired so much and no one really recognises you. But the good thing about Doctor Who is that they do get to go to play all of that. I'm stopping now. Yeah. That's me on monsters. I'll see you
now. Right. And in this one, they get some of the best monster effects as well with the BBC Well, you know, Troughton had the foam machine, but now we've got the BBC puke machine that they've been using on Little Britain for the vomiting old ladies sketch, which I think is now being. And if one thing, I wonder if there ever was a meeting where, you know, they're saying, okay, so we've got this water spurting out of them. Should they do the noise? Should they like, I think it's probably wise not to. I think the soundless machine. It'd be a bit less mysterious.
I adore the scene when they're on the roof and CG water is just sort of pouring out of their open mouths.
Yeah.
I think it's like not convincing for a second, but I absolutely do not care.
it's like Doctor Who has moved to HD and we've got to have one special effect per episode where we haven't quite got that yet. So, you know, the bus cricket bat into the stingray last episode. And then because I was watching one going, yeah, this is really great CG for the base. And this is great. And no, don't do that. No.
It is incredible CG for the base. Oh my goodness, it looks great.
Yeah, like so many beauty shots of that.
Yeah.
Especially the explosion. What about the robot?
Oh,
gadget.
But it's sort of deliberately, isn't it? Like, it's meant to have been built by a teenager.
Yeah.
He says he built it,
It feels like it was going to be something they were going to do a bit more with, because it's given a lot of build up in the Doctor saying he doesn't. First of all, he says he doesn't like robots, but actually he's like, I don't like humans that design smart ass robots.
Yeah.
But then he's like, oh no, I still don't like comedy robots. And then he's like, I love comedy robots. And it's kind of like, I suppose I would have liked Gadget to somehow have a little personality, because he's obviously meant to be Johnny Five. Russell T. Davies suggested him because he'd just seen WALL-E and loved it.
Right.
So, but then again, you know, we're given no reason to believe Gadget has any personality or autonomy or whatever.
It is a little bit of a shame. I like having a silly robot, because otherwise this is kind of Alien or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, for it to be Doctor Who, you know, we need a silly robot.
Yeah.
And it doesn't shy away from using the silly robot to, you know, twice get them out of trouble and, in fact, to kind of save the day at the end.
Yeah. And I have to say, Graham Harper's being a bit cheeky when he first uses Gadget to get him out of trouble, because Tennant sort of crouches down out of shot, and the next shot of Roman is shot from pretty much between his legs looking up and him going, what? It's really cheeky. And I refuse to believe Graham doesn't know what he's doing. In terms of innuendo, not necessarily in terms of anything Graham may or may not get up to in his private life.
I'm also a massive fan of the trail of fire afterwards as well. Like, it is absolutely cartoonish and absolutely.
That's
here for
not
it.
Realistic science. Well,
that's interesting, because like I think it, like, a lot of this story, like the monsters, whatever, like, it works. Like, Russell said, he wanted the robot to be funny, annoying, and Disney, and it's tick tick tick. It absolutely is those things. I read a review afterwards in the Guardian, and they said, the only thing I didn't like was that bloody robot. And wrote quite an interesting thing. He said, maybe it was a bit of a relief for the children, but who cares about them? It's not really for them, is it? And that's the end of the review. And it's kind of a good point, as in, it does what they intend it to do. It's completely in place for Doctor Who, a rattly old robot, and he even refers to K-9. But tonally in this story, it does something about it. I don't know, like, there's a lot in this story that does exactly what they want it to do, but it still feels unsettling. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of tonal and thematic contradictions in this story, hugely. But Gadget sort of encapsulates what I feel about this story. It completely does exactly what they want it to do. I just don't know if I like it. Is that, like, it's the right choice, but I don't kind of like it. It's weird.
And coming back to it, it was less dark, just less visually dark than I had remembered from when I watched it. The station is actually a really bright, and obviously there's the really dark themes building, and then we'll get to the ending when we get to it, of course. But at that point, the first scenes, establishing scenes, where the Doctor just arrives and announces that he's the Doctor, and it's pretty much like, oh yeah, we're a base, we're under siege, you're Doctor Who, right, yeah, you better stay here and help us, even though he doesn't want to. It's like everyone apart from him wants him to be the Doctor in a base under siege story. And that tension's there without it being made super dark and super gritty and, oh, this is a really dark one. So it's unsettling rather than being absolutely terrifying from the off, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, Russell said, it's there's a lot of talk about it's a story you can only do once. You know, he said it's like a total base under siege, but within that format, it's going absolutely mad. And he says this story has a lot of this story has a lot of stresses and strains in it, or you know, which I think is that's really interesting. And there is a lot. This story is barely managing to contain itself.
It's like it's got that weight of the series becoming about this one character's complete dominance, and how can the show cope when one character is as dominant as that over the entire history of the show? And his name's David Tennant, and he's playing the Doctor, and the Doctor is also the most powerful. He's done what Tom Baker never did and had a run of stories with no companion, because and at the time that was annoying me so much. And looking back, I'm like, okay, yeah, they were actually doing that deliberately and playing with it. But at the time, I was. Why is this show about the awesomeness of the Doctor now? I don't want that. But then this does. Well, this sort of addresses it, and then next week doesn't. But it's right in the heart of this episode.
So I mean, we've already had the show talking about what happens when the Doctor doesn't have a companion in that second Christmas special. So as early as that, and so this story can only be done if there isn't a companion, because you would have Donna sort of puncturing him or telling him what to do or telling him to rein it in or something like that, or he would be embarrassed to behave like that in front of, you know, Rose or Martha.
And I love the way Adelaide just isn't remotely impressed by his shtick and doesn't even see it as her role to improve him in the way that Donna did. I wondered why they had that tension between Adelaide and Ed, and like which is touched on right in his last words, as maybe having had. He says, you never could forgive me, is like, I think it's his last words, which is to just leave us to ponder. But you know, maybe he left her cat out or something when they were launching. but she's clean and she's not impressed by flashy guys, and so she's and that sets her up as not being remotely impressed by the Doctor's antics. And her performance, what I love about her performance in this is the way that every scene her disdain for him just grows, or it starts out as wariness and then it becomes disdain, and so she's absolutely on a path to that final scene right from the beginning is Lindsay Duncan. And I think I know Helen Mirren has been put down as being their first choice, and that's why she's not Russian, because Helen is that, I read that somewhere, that because Helen Mirren was a Russian in 2010, they're like, oh, we better change this character and not have a Russian anymore. And then that just stayed even when they got Lindsay Duncan. But I couldn't imagine anyone doing it better than Lindsay Duncan does. I think she's one of the best guest stars we've ever had. And I don't like Ed. Do people still debate whether she counts as a companion just because her name's in the credits? I mean, she's not. She's someone who the Doctor fleetingly tries to screw up her destiny and fails. That doesn't make her a companion, no. Does it?
Yeah, Astrid's not a companion.
Yeah, she doesn't tick any of the boxes.
Katerina is, but
she is absolutely incredible. And, you know, I remember seeing her in Rome where she played Brutus's mother. She's amazing in that. And then she's in that Black Mirror episode where she's Rory Kinnear's kind of chief of staff or something.
Yeah. Rory Kinnear's Peter Capaldi.
Yeah. And she is absolutely superb in that as well. That's a deeply upsetting episode, but everyone's playing it so incredibly straight. And she's absolutely just marvelous in it.
I hadn't seen Rome when this first was broadcast, but now having seen Rome, when the Doctor says to Adelaide, imagine you were in Pompeii, I laugh. It's quite extraordinary how that amazing sequence where the Doctor's walking away from the base and the comms are still open. And we've had earlier lines where basically the comms are open. You know, they don't have private comms channels, so they have to keep it clear. But, you know, I found myself thinking, why is he still listening? And then I remembered a year before this, we've had Silence in the Library, where it's like, can we just switch Mrs. Evangelista off? And it's like, no, show some respect. If you have left people to die, you are going to listen to their last words. And I think that's the idea here. And the extraordinary thing is, almost shot for shot, Daenerys Targaryen in the final episode of Game of Thrones, or second last episode, has a similar kind of moment of, I'm hearing this stuff and I'm saying no. And that seems to be influenced by this. And I'd be interested to know if anyone knows of any antecedents to this where a character just kind of does the no more thing. Because, you know, as much as it gives Tennant an opportunity to gnash his teeth, I can always appreciate that build-up with this version of the character who, you know, we see when Rose has her face stolen and when he's drowning the Rachnos, that he's never actually far away from going too far. And not having the companion here, he doesn't... Usually it's the companion who says, but why can't we change history? And he turns around and says, "But well, the laws of time, etc., etc." He doesn't... It's not that he doesn't have someone to say that to him. He's got no reason to say it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like he's probably in his head, he's going, okay, this is the moment where I have to explain why I can't change. There's no one here. Why? Actually, you know what?
Yeah.
You know what? And that whole bit inside there reminds me of another thing from my childhood. There's an old anime called The Genie Family. From, I think, the 60s or 70s, late 60s. And when I was a kid, it was redubbed as a show called Bob in a Bottle. And it was about these genies, and you had Bob, who was summoned by sneezing, and you had his daughter Yawna, who was summoned by yawning. They obviously ran out of names. But
how did you summon his father?
I can't say. This isn't possible. But I remember the last episode because unlike, say, a lot of American or British animation, Japanese animes would finish. They would have a last episode. And in the last episode, basically, genies, after they've been in service for a certain period of time, have to go back to the genie world for 1,000 years. But they can only do that if they're back in their bottle. So his family, his human family that he lives with, conspire, you know, we're not going to sneeze, we're not going to yawn. And these sort of Rube Goldberg things happen. Like, time is influencing things around Bowie Base. This Rube Goldberg kind of stuff happens to make the father sneeze and to make the kid yawn. And the kid is screaming at the end, no, come back, come back, come back, as the bottle and his friends fly off. And that was the end of the show. And I saw that at 10.
Wow.
And wow. I was traumatized for weeks. And this creates the same feeling that time is kind of going, no, Doctor, this is a terrible idea, stop. And it's not time being cruel, you know, it's time going, actually, this is going to eventually lead to all these good things that you've already told us about, stop screwing it up.
So we come to the point which is the thing that I really seriously don't like about the episode. And it's really the reason why Planet of the Dead edges this one out for me. It is the fact that the Doctor doesn't have a proper reason not to save these people. And the Doctor is someone who has always... disregarded rules and prioritized people's welfare and safety over obedience to rules. And there isn't really such a thing as a fixed point in time. And so we have a made-up science fiction moral principle, and I find it impossible to identify in any way with the moral dilemma that the Doctor finds himself in. And so... And the fact that we don't have anyone to explain it to, and so all we get are the pages from the BBC News website saying what will happen, it doesn't work for me, I think. And we talked about this in our Fires of Pompeii episode, that there is a problem with Doctor Who and history, and a thing that wrecks many, many historical stories is the fact that the Doctor can't change history. And that's a terrible imposition which heaps of, you know, producers have avoided in the past by just not doing historicals or whatever. So you have the Doctor and he can't do anything. We're imposing that restriction, as you said before, Pete, we're imposing that restriction of having a historical but setting it in the future and saying that this is something that the doctor can't change. And it's not entirely clear to me whether it is just a moral constraint or it is a sort of time-related constraint. What you were saying before, Brendan, if the doctor tries, there's a line saying that if the doctor tries to change this, he ends up responsible for causing it to happen, as happened in Pompeii. But that doesn't seem to be quite what happens here. And so him agonizing over that decision just, it doesn't quite work for me, I think.
I think the show's always tried to have it both ways, and particularly in this era with the idea of some, one week someone will say there's no such thing as little people and everybody's important, and then the next week it's, in Fires of Pompeii. He saved those people because Donna cried, to stop Donna crying. He didn't save their next door neighbours or the cleaners. And it was like, because she, yeah, that you, I guess it just doesn't, it won't work if we dig too deep into that, or why he didn't just take everyone from Bowie Base and fly them off into space and let them run a space freezer center together and just tell everyone about it.
They could have gone to the planet Colchicron and kept the Gravis company.
And yet, while viewing it, I still find that more satisfying, what we get, than the Time Lords are all hiding in a bottle, pretending to be dead, and sort of work around that does, and everybody lives work around, I suppose.
Yeah.
Maybe I was brutalized by Eric Sayward when I was young.
So, we all were.
I think it comes in the fact that, time travel is a paradox. And so you're going to end up in a point where you do have to gloss over it because it just doesn't work. You cannot think that too far. So I think it's just rooted in that. And I think the program is now so popular and so successful that the actual production of the program and the story itself is becoming so married. As Pete said, David Tennant and the Doctor, is hard to distinguish either of them now, who we're celebrating and worshipping. And so basically, he should have regenerated at the end of Journey's End. That was the end of the 10th Doctor. It's the best ending you could possibly have. So we're on borrowed time. So we've already pushed way beyond. We've sort of stepped outside the programme and we're stretching it and pushing it. And Russell did say, this programme has stresses and strains. It pushes and it tests you. So this is a programme about too much of a good thing and going too far. And the programme itself has gone too far. So this story has gone way too far. He shouldn't even be here. He should have regenerated. So it is pushing that paradox thing we normally gloss over by either fix or flux. We've now kind of pushed beyond that. So yeah, everything in it is like this story does everything they wanted it to do. It's just like, should they have done it is sort of the question. It's seeded right throughout the story. I mean, the whole story is Waters on Mars. It's about humanity trying to find water. Well, you got it. You found water. Your cup runneth over. It's just like, too much of a good thing. And it's every level of this story is just about going too far. And it's a really successful, I think, accurate, well-built, intentional story of what happens when you go too far, whether you go too far in a monster effect or, all of these things. And just the question is whether you should or shouldn't. And it's really clever because actually that's, the form and content marry up to this philosophical question of like, should you go, how much of a good thing should you have? So I think that's why it breaks. I think it's so I can see why you don't like it. Cause you're like, no, this has just gone too far. And it's like, yeah, that's what they were doing. Is that a good thing or not? Should they have done? Do they have the right?
But I also sort of expect Russell to create a sort of moral dilemma that I can in some way sympathise with. The end of Journey's End, where Rose gets dumped back in her parallel universe with a cloned copy of her soulmate and heart's desire, and you kind of think, I have literally no way of knowing how to feel about this. I don't know. What is that good? It's impossible to tell. Do you know what I mean? And I think even Russell himself in the writer's tale might say something about his sort of dissatisfaction with that. Here it's kind of like, I don't know what the analogue is. Do you know what I mean? Shouldn't I really be rooting for the Doctor to just say, oh, you know, screw it, I'm saving these people, you know, whatever?
It's kind of his Tom Baker with holding the key to time moment, isn't it? Maybe. That's what it reminds me of. There's that split second where Tom does his goofy face and says he could rule the entire universe. So actually, maybe we shouldn't have bothered having this season at all. but it's an arc. But
he's going to go around saving people he's not allowed to save. Do you know what I mean? That doesn't seem all that threatening or out of control. And it's certainly basically what he does every story.
But he's got the added pressure now of some random woman on a bus telling him someone would knock four times. That would freak me out.
I mean, I also think for a long-term viewer seeing this, we're invited to empathize with Adelaide. So when, you know, the Doctor is controlling Gadget and again showing his teeth and what have you, and we're kind of getting Murray Gold's triumph music playing, but then we cut to Lindsay Duncan just shaking her head going no. So that it's for, you know, for once it's not Murray Gold's music telling us how to feel, it's an actual performance telling us how to feel. But I think the other thing for a long-term viewer is way back in series one, when Rose saves Pete from the car, she actually says to the Doctor, so it's okay when we go to other times and places and save people, but not when it's me saving my dad. And this is kind of a further comment on that conversation and to kind of show us the consequences of that, because when Pete is saved and he's not meant to be saved, he sacrifices himself for the greater good in a more tangible way than we see Adelaide here, because, you know, there's no immediate threat to Adelaide's survival. The threat is 50 years down the line when her daughter does or does not take, you know, the Enterprise NX-01 on a mission to meet the Zindi or whatever. Sorry, watched Lower Decks last night. But to me, and I think it's because I'm a bit more canon-obsessed than you are, Nathan, I do enjoy the moral dilemma here, and I can buy into it, but it makes me kind of feel this story the way I feel about, first of all, the Caves of Androzani. And it's and as Russell says about this, you can't do this every week.
No.
You could not have this story every week. It would be too bleak and too depressing. The other thing it makes me think of is Earthshock, because a lot of this story doesn't really make sense on a second viewing. You know, it's kind of like the rocket blows up and Maggie goes and screams at the iceberg and it starts breaking up as well. And it's like, okay, so what's the plan here now you've lost the rocket, actually? Like,
I don't care. I love that scene.
Yeah. don't get me wrong. It's, but this is the thing. On first viewing, I'm like, yeah, scream at that ice and break it. And okay. But yeah, this time around, I'm like,
we were all hoping for a little green claw to come out, weren't we? A little green pincer.
Yes. Actually, yeah, there is kind of that scene earlier where it's like the Doctor saying, you know, there used to be Martians here, did they? Are we going to see them? No. Give it a few years, Gatiss will bring them back.
I love the flashback to Adelaide as a child looking at the Dalek,
yes,
which is kind of, I think, reconditioned and lifted from Battlestar Galactica. Not the child element, but without wanting to spoil a Battlestar Galactica, there's a bit in Battlestar Galactica where someone looks something that's about to kill him in the eye, and then it goes away, and it turns out to be their destiny being the Factor. I watching that now, I think, oh, for a kid who had watched... All right, it wasn't all that long ago. But if you were a kid who'd watched Journey's End, and then a little while later you're watching this, it must have sort of put them in her shoes of flashing back to that story from the previous season. But I just really like that.
I think too, the fact that it's set only 50 years in the future, when the kid who you're talking about, Pete, can still expect to be alive. I think that's actually really terribly cool.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that does work for me is linking what's happening here to what happens to the future of humanity. You know, like, I don't care about canon, whatever, but I love the idea that you know, we start with Bowie Bass 1, and then a couple of generations down the line, we're doing Lightspeed, and then we're heading out into the galaxy. And it gives Russell the chance to put his Russell spin on that, that is the result of, you know, human ingenuity and people being inspired and all sorts of things like that. And that an extraordinary woman who's so obviously an extraordinary person, when we see her in action, that she's kind of the start of all that.
It's really interesting. I think it depends on what you think about humanity, whether that's a good thing or not. Like, I personally think, you know, this okay, here we go. But I mean, actually,
are you pro or anti on balance?
Well, frankly, I'm anti. I actually think the real, you know, this race, you know, obviously the Earth is getting you know, we've destroyed that, and it's now sort of the race against time is, oh, can we colonize other planets, you know, can we make life sustainable so humans can go on? And I sort of think the race is the other way. I just think, come on, it's time. Like, Earth has had its time. Us people, we people have had our time. And I think the worst thing that can happen is that we go spreading out everywhere. And it's touched on in this. It's like, you know, Adelaide refers to the oil wars, and that humans on the verge of extinction. Yeah, and humanity is on the verge of extinction. And again, it's a story.
It's starting in 2020.
There we go.
Starting in 2020.
Yeah. She said 40 years.
Yes. Yeah. And guess what, boys and girls? Right here, right now, it's oil wars. Let's do it. But again, it's that theme of things going too far and living past their time. And it's like, should they or not? And humanity, whether Nathan, you say you feel, you know, of course, there's no question here. Of course you save them. Of course you save, you know. Mind you, then again, it's a weird loop, because if you save them, then you actually stop the human race in a way, because it's her granddaughter that goes out and saves them. So I would say in this case, yes, save them short term. No, don't save the humans long term. But this very much depends on where you're coming from in your life choices and emotional state. So it's kind of, but it does have that. You know, that the whole the setting of the botanic gardens in Wales, they use those biodomes, just make you think of Silent Running, that, you know, the movie of just them trying to keep a little Garden of Eden going way past you know, when it should. This question of whether humanity should keep going or not, should be saved or not, is it does put it squarely in your lap.
Well, I don't know that I want to live in a universe where the invisible enemy didn't happen, so.
And this takes me back. I mean, 2009, it was just like the sort of tail end of the whole Cool Britannia era, where you could stick Union Jacks on things and they made you think of kitsch 60s revivalism rather than hating foreigners. And it was a nice little period. And having the bass named after David Bowie was good. Little ties to David Bowie there. Yeah. Bowie ties are cool, I think.
Oh dear.
I'd written that one down. It was funnier in my head as well.
Just going back to the Dalek briefly, and it has to be said, like a shout out to all the sort of sets, the graves they're dancing on, in terms of like the base being the sort of control center of the base is the old Torchwood hub that they blew up last season. It's all based on that now. It's now Bowie Base. And of course, Sarah Jane's attic, of course, was the attic she was looking out of, which is, it's got this very weird sort of theme to it. At the time, I remember that Dalek came in, because I think Pete, you said earlier, like where I was with the show is like, I have had enough of this. And so when the Dalek turned up, I was like, this just feels like a continuity reference too far. And it's funny, David Tennant said that he felt it was very bold to have a reference to Journey's End. He's like, wow, that's a really bold reference. I was like, wow, stick around for the next 10 years. but then Russell's like, well, no, actually, we were getting over 10 million. Yeah, people are going to remember it.
Yeah.
And it all just comes down to this thing is and also, I think I've been more forgiving watching it this time around, because, of course, the show itself going this far, doing this extra lap, was like, I totally sort of see why they did it. It's so insanely popular. I mean, I just rewatched the when David Tennant was announcing his leaving, which I found nauseating at the time. And if you watch it now, it's pretty full on. So it was just like briefly, it's National Television Awards 2008. He's winning an award for outstanding drama performance. He can't be there, of course, because he's in the middle of what was in theatrical industry known as Space Hamlet, because it had Patrick Stewart and David Tennant in it. And he's there and he's in the interval of giving his award-winning Hamlet, just giving this simultaneously accepting his outstanding drama award and handing in his resignation and announcing his resignation. It's kind of crazy. And just to make it even more insane, he's got two of his mates from the production dressed in royal guards behind him. So it looks like a royal address. And if you hear the room...
Murray Gold on a little Casio.
I mean, it may as well be. At least it would drown out the sound of the screaming girls. And it's like, it's really, no, it's genuinely remarkable. I was like, I don't know who was on the guest list for that National TV Awards, but honestly, the tickets are like, it's a third daughter's in there. It's like, it's really big, like rock star screaming when he's on. Kids shouting out, hey, we love you, David. And it's like the second he appears, everyone's screaming. And when he says, oh, but I will be back, but it's going to be my last, you know, the sound of a million girls' hearts breaking around, booming, you know, it's easy to forget how insanely popular the show was and how successful they were and how Russell must have felt and how David must have felt. And of course, the BBC would have just going more, more, more. The question was at the time, could Doctor Who survive without David Tennant? Yeah. Now, that all drove me nuts at the time because he is genuinely, and I'm not being contrarian about this, but he's genuinely my least favourite Doctor, genuinely. But watching it this time, I was like, no, I mean, I can totally see why they went too far, in inverted commas. They were absolutely, like Gadget, they were driving this car. They were like, sod it, we're going on this thing. Let's put the foot down and burn everything. So I can totally see why they did it. It's just a question of whether they should have done or not. To my taste, just to say, I would have loved it to end at Journey's End. I think the Runaway Bride, I think you need someone to stop you. And that shot of him destroying a monster, I was like, I got it. I totally got it. We know what happens when he goes too far. So you need someone to stop you. So I didn't really need to see this personally. But it is worth saying that most people wanted to see this and much, much more. When it came to I Don't Want to Go, I remember I was shouting at the screen like, Patsy Stone, oh, for God's sake, just die.
Is Todd here?
And then, oh, dear. What? Yeah. Oh, yikes. And then, of course, he comes back in the anniversary and says, I don't want to go. And now he's back as a Time Lord Victorious. And I'm stepping away from that there. So, broadly speaking, like generously, it's like this whole, like, should this whole thing have happened? Should this, I mean, it's really clever the way they've married this story to what was going on in the production of and going on in Doctor Who. Should Doctor Who go this far? It can. They do it well. I personally didn't want them to do it. I didn't need this victory lap, but it depends on your point of view, I guess.
I have to say that the other thing that I dislike about this episode is the opportunities it gives David to do teeth acting and hair acting. I just find him really quite obnoxious at the end of this. really, really unlikable. And I do think the one thing that he does well is he still tries to do the sort of funny doctor thing, you know, as part of that performance. When he comes in and he's all sort of hubris and ordering people around and teeth and shouting and stuff, there's still Doctor Who-y lines that would be fun in another context but aren't.
Yeah, but my aversion to it has really reduced over the years, I think, because now I see him doing all that in this, and I think, okay, he's being the addict who's hitting another dose and another dose of being the Doctor, and it's not giving him the high, and it's driving him to distraction, and he's almost trying to fake it. Like, you know, the bit, so when he turns around and does go back to the base after Steffi's died, because he's like, oh, okay, now she's dead, I'll go back, the rest of them I'll save. Which is possibly with her stupid accident, was wandering up and down the Danube. he goes back and he's like, yeah, I'm here, I'm going to save you. And it always annoyed me when he did that, because again, Doctor Who isn't a superhero, and I don't want the entire population of the Earth to worship him. He should be slipping away quietly, but that's the opposite of what this era was doing. But so when he does do that and it doesn't work for him, and he just completely fails, I kind of think, I don't know. There's a degree of it's like his like Pertwee's vanity coming back at the end to get him in Planet of the Spiders, I guess. Vanity's the wrong word, but you know what I mean. The idea that the Doctor's his vanity and his quest for knowledge in Planet of the Spiders, and for the Tenth Doctor, it's this idea that he is a superhero and a god that does ultimately stop working for him. But then, how much that actually comes into play in the actual regeneration story is another matter. But as a pre-finale story, I like what it does with that. Yeah.
Look, like Caves of Androzani, I think it's a wonderful piece of drama, and I think objectively it's the best of the specials. But I still much prefer watching Planet of the Dead. Planet of the Dead is still my favourite because it's fun. End of Time started life as one episode, got stretched into two, and really shouldn't have been. Whereas this, I'm just like, oh yes, this is very worthy, this is very worthy, this is very worthy. Can I start having fun, please?
And in fact, the Doctor says what his mission is. It's, you know, the Doctor, yeah. Doctor, fun. Yeah. You know, and...
Well, it ties in with him failing.
He completely fails to do that.
Yeah.
And I guess that conception of the Doctor, it's deliberate, isn't it? Like, he, Russell knows that we're not going to be having fun accompanying the Doctor by the end of this episode. It's very clever. But I grow weary, and we get it in the Moffat era as well, where being the Doctor is this sort of terrible burden and, maybe I'll just kill myself or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I dislike that enormously. And I like the
Am
Doctor...
Am I having a good arc?
But it's like the Doctor being sad or the Doctor being lonely. Do you know what I mean? All of that's great. I thought, you know, it gave the Doctor some interiority that he kind of lacks more often than not in the classic series. But the Doctor being Batman, you know, where he's a superhero, but only because terrible things have happened to him and he's having a miserable time.
Can I just say, as a big fan of Batman 1966, not all Batmans. I'm just going to say that.
See, I was actually going to point at you, Conrad, which is fun on audio.
Yeah, I picked it up.
Because shortly before we reconnected, I watched all of Batman 66. And then while you were watching all of Batman 66, I was getting your opinions on it as well. And it's like, yeah, actually, Batman doesn't... just because you've been through those traumatic events doesn't mean you have to be grim, dark, and horrible. But there are several times where the Adam West Bruce Wayne talks as much as he could in the 60s about Batman's tragic past.
Wow.
But specifically kind of says, that's why I do this charitable work, that's why I help these people, that's why I do this, without big overblown, I am the Lord of Time and the laws of time will obey me, etc.
Absolutely.
Which does fit the character, and at least at the end of this, the plot immediately repudiates that and says, no, this is a terrible idea, and we're not going to go down this path for at least another 11 years when we will do a multimedia spectacular based on it.
It is a head-on. It's a head-on confrontation of it rather than just doing it, I think.
Yeah. To me, too, I think it is just the plot that makes him, that calms him down, rather than anything better than that. And I think that having Adelaide shoot herself in the face off screen is not what I want very much for Doctor Who. And, you know, like, I think it's probably something that you would never do now.
I think it's part of the breaking of the format.
Yeah.
They're taking it to a logical and horrible conclusion. And, you know, the basic thing they're breaking, first of all, is the Doctor saves people. Because, first of all, he says, well, no, I'm not going to save you.
Yeah.
But then it's like, I'm going to save you.
But it'll be bad.
But it'll be, not only will it be bad, I'm doing it for me.
Yeah.
Because as soon as everyone falls out of the TARDIS, he's like, well, is no one going to thank me?
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm doing it for me. And then the final thing is, you know, the one person the Doctor really wanted to save, because he pretty much says he doesn't care about Yuri and Mia. And he doesn't care about Gadget. Oh, Gadget's lost his signal. Oh, well. the one person he cares about kind of goes, actually, no, you're not in charge of me. Because when Adelaide sets that bomb, she is saying, I do this to save the Earth and to save my family. And the Doctor takes that away from her and she kind of goes, no.
Yeah. You see, I don't buy that either. Do you know what I mean? Is she just shooting herself because David Tennant's been a massive dick? Or, like,
I've liked most of the two previous seasons.
In 2009, all sharp objects removed my house in 2009.
You don't put away those teeth.
But it is like, that's the thing. It is her absolutely, yeah, she is in charge of her destiny. And she seeds that, and every look on her face throughout the whole episode is Lindsay Duncan building up to that moment. So that when you first watch it, it's a massive shock. And when you rewatch it, she's absolutely building a path to it. And I think if it had the original ending of him just letting her live and then feeling a bit worried and guilty about it afterwards, I mean, because that's what it's for, isn't it? Despite within the episode, it's to enable him to have that, oh my God, what have I done? And the rather over the top crash zoom. And then there's the crash zoom on him and the what have I done face. And then it flashes back to him hearing what she just said 20 seconds ago.
It's a different take. Yeah, I think so.
That's possibly the only thing that I would say is a directorial slip. I don't know why he's having a flashback to something that he just heard her say 20 seconds earlier. It's like, yeah, we were right there watching. But it's all for that punch.
I also think it's cheating because somehow bringing her back to Earth and having her inspire Susie in person after having escaped from Mars, that won't work. That'll wreck human history. But having Susie and her mother come over to Adelaide's house one day and find her sort of face down, you know, on the living room floor with a pool of blood round her head, that is going to inspire. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just we're making the rules up at this point, whatever.
Yeah, I agree. That's another thing that doesn't quite work.
The Reapers turned up.
I think maybe there's a two-way comm link, video link, and the daughter and granddaughter have been watching all of these events, and as soon as Lindsay Duncan's grandma comes home, they shoot her.
They were waiting behind
They've
the door.
They've been watching it. They're big David Tennant fans. They're like, no, you got to go. No, maybe not. But it's weird, though, and it's like, again, it's worth saying, you know, that is an extreme moment in Doctor Who. It does break the programme. It feels outside the programme. It feels odd at the time. You know, thank goodness this thing wasn't the... It was going to be a Christmas special, originally called Red Christmas, which is a great title. But it was originally going to be a bullet, an old school pistol, because deliberately with the whole Bowie base thing, they wanted it to be very NASA, very Star Trek, but kind of believable. So they actually didn't want too many whiz bangy things. They actually didn't want laser guns, but. The producer, again, one of the many, many things they turned down in this, they're like, no, we are not having anyone shooting themselves with a real gun. There'll be a laser zap. So it turns out that the person when you watch the production of this thing, the person who keeps turning down the nonsense or keeps turning down this or keeps turning down that, even a huge stunt when there's that explosion, David was like, I'm doing this explosion. I'm doing this huge stunt. I'm doing this huge stunt. And they were like, no, I'm not having that. When he says, like, the Doctor should have someone to stop you, it appears to be Nikki Wilson, the producer, who seems to, every turn, she seems to be, like, toning it down. But it is that's a very extraordinary moment. It does feel, that just feels too far. It feels too much to me. Yeah. They do it, again, they do it really well. They justify it within the story. It's just a question of should they do it. In fact, I've got a moral question. I've got a moral dilemma for you all. Let's say we go back to Rothlock Base, 2009, let's say, or 2008, when they're saying, okay, we've done Journey's End. This is amazing. David's going off. He's doing Hamlet, but he might get some time off. What do we do? Do we pull the plug or should we go, you know, and the BBC really want us to do it. They're throwing money at us. Do you go back and stop them from making that extra year or do you let them do it? Come on, there's the four of us. We've got to go back. We've got to make the decision.
I agree with you, Conrad. I think that these don't work really well, and I think that Doctor Who as specials doesn't work really well. I like a season. I think making its way at 7 months for this, and then having this be the thing that we have for the next month or so before we see the next thing. I don't think any of them work particularly well, but I love Doctor Who that fails in various ways. And you know, we're going to get four episodes of FTE out of it, so I'm absolutely here for it.
Wow.
No, mercy. I think you're both mad. I think you're both mad and deranged and must be stopped, because without these, because this kept the momentum going, and it did. It did do. When Moffat was on the verge of launching his new sort of more very fairy tale-y version, and that's not a pejorative word from me. I've got lots of other pejorative words for Moffat, but that's not one. And this new, completely different style of Doctor Who was coming. And so to have these episodes where Russell T. Davies did everything in different directions to 200%, kept it in very much in the public eye, kept it really live, and meant that from the second, from Tennant's actual departure, to Matt Smith's arrival, it's only a few weeks. It's only about 10 weeks or something, isn't it, between the end of the Tennant era and 11th Hour going out. And I think without that, you have one of these 18-month gaps that we've now got used to, where it just loses momentum from the public eye completely.
Unless it's filled with Time Lord Victorious with lots of pictures of David Tennant and, you know, with in hero poses with explosions. So don't worry, he's got us covered for quite some time. Brendan, it's all down. So Pete, you're saying in this Rothlock scenario, you're going to let them keep going?
Yeah.
Okay. Brendan, it's all down to you, mate. What are you? You get the casting vote. What?
I'm going to say I'm going to say let them keep going for much the same reason as Pete does, because these run of specials, it's, and we've seen this from Russell's subsequent work, Russell T. Davies has quite a dark streak, and he's been keeping a lot of it at bay in Doctor Who, and this is the moment where instead he goes, okay, we know we've got a definite out. We know that the program will go on beyond us. Let's experiment. And Planet of the Dead is pretty trad, you know, and pretty fun with it. Waters of Mars, it breaks the show in such a way that they know that even though they've got two more episodes to do, they're not going to do this again. End of Time is a spectacular failure. And I mean that in terms of it is an impressive spectacle. It has good performances from Tennant and Sim and Bernard Cribbins and pretty much everyone. And, you know, sexiest Bond alive, Timothy Dalton.
I know.
But it
most,
doesn't
most
work.
Most Shaggable Barusa means... is the next poll.
Philip Latham.
hang on, or is he Rassilon? Sorry.
he's Rassilon. I thought asking for him, Shaggable
Barusa. Well, we can do them both.
It's okay now. According to Chris Chibnall, they're the same person, I'm sure.
sorry.
But it means that when Matt Smith avoids crashing into Big Ben, and we have that beautiful first year with him and Karen Gillan, if that had come off the back of Series 4, it just would have felt like more of the same.
Mm.
The specials give us a chance to kind of go... It's kind of like the Doctor saying, the Ice Warriors live here, you know? Yeah, we're not going to show you them, though. This is what Doctor Who could be. Don't worry, we're not going to do that. I love Series 5, but I think I might have loved it a little bit less if I hadn't been a bit turned off by Waters of Mars and the End of Time.
Mm. So we are deadlocked.
So we deadlocked, but this whole episode, when it aired, there's a tribute, of course, at the end. The special is dedicated to Barry Letts. Now, if anybody can get it and break this stalemate and have an opinion on it, we're like, what would Barry do? Or what would he think? That's the big one.
Yeah. I mean, the Barry Letts era is spectacular and lovely in all sorts of ways, but it's not that wildly experimental, though, is it?
Yeah. He would be saying, what would he be saying?
I think he'd be with you, Conrad, to be honest, because, you know, he very, very early on got hauled over the coals for being too scary and actually agreed and kind of went, okay, we'll pull it back a bit. and, you know, did so, but still managed to make scary Doctor Who with a strong moral direction, because he often spoke about the morality of the program and how the Doctor doesn't do certain things. And, you know, he's the man who never would carry a gun unless you're an Ogron or a dinosaur. you know, but certainly, you know, is the only other instance of suicide by gun in Doctor Who Image of the Fendal?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think we'll get one in the Capaldi era. I think there might be one in A Mummy on the Orient Express, but previously I think it's something Doctor was definitely shied away from.
Yeah. Of course we had Donna blowing herself up a few weeks ago, with her suicide vest.
I mean, there've been a lot of people blow themselves up to, you know, sacrifice themselves for others and stuff. But I do think that the gun to the head thing is just a little bit kind of, you know, and she's not under threat. Nothing's going to happen to her if she doesn't do it. And so I just think, you know, it's unfortunate. That's all we have time for now. We'll be back in the next few weeks to see what the Noble family have been getting up to in the End of Time Part 1. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jodie into Terror. Pete, where can people find you?
I'm prof_quitemess on Twitter, and I'll crop up from time to time on the lovely Trap1_podcast.
And Conrad, where can people find you?
You can also find me on Twitter at hairofthehound_, and like Pete, I'm often on the Trap1 podcast.
So until next time, remember that the very best way to lose a few pounds is to condense all your oxygen membranes. I'm doing it now. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
This never would have happened to Matt Damon.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones, Pete Lambert and Conrad Westmus. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Fix or Flux, was recorded on the 11th of October 2020 and released on the 21st of November. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm planning to nip back in time to 1987 and persuade Bonnie Langford to stay on for another season. See you when I get back.
What do we want to do? I don't think we can go back to talking about things. Should we wind it up?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I just got a email from my boss.
I'm presuming this is probably going to be the tag. So something I noticed, which is totally frivolous. When Lindsay Dunker's name comes up, Lindsay and Duncan are not aligned with each other.
Wow. I hope someone got fired for that.
Yeah. and someone done it with Helen Mirren, and they had to go back and edit it. We can't bloody afford. We're not paying that much.
and because it's my last episode of the RTD era, I'm not on the End of Time, I'd just like to say for the last time, the end credits vortex is not centered, and it really annoys me. They could do it in 1974. What's your excuse, Milk? Whatever you call yourselves.
Wow. I didn't realize they'd been eating you away since 2005.
Brendan, you've been doing this for way too long. No one should have this much power.
I am the Lord of Peppermint Chocolate, so it will obey me. It'll stay off my goddamn hips.
This is a shame that Adelaide didn't stay around for a couple more days. She could have watched the 96th anniversary special of Doctor Who on BBC One on the 23rd, 24th, 21, whatever it was.
Rod did rightly point out this morning that it would actually be his centenary because he was born in 1959.
Oh, wow.
He also said, well, as the credits were rolling, well, that was just stupid, wasn't it? I'm like, why was it stupid? He said, well, I told you when we watched it last time. I said, darling, that was 2015. Can you just explain it to me again? And he's like, the science in Doctor Who needs to be sensible, because the science of the ship itself is not, so everything else needs to be sensible around it. You can accept the ship, but everything else needs to follow the rules. And, you know, I thought he was going to talk about time or time paradoxes. Mm. And he's like, they would not be able to produce that much water in that little time to get through the base.
They were creating water.
But he's like, I get that they're creating water, but first of all, what from? But he's like, secondly, It's 10 feet of whatever it is.
Yeah, there's lots of lines about it's 10 feet of concrete that we brought here without being able to pack a couple of bikes. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was constantly worried about how they built it. Mm-hmm. You know, it did seem like they would have burnt up, you know, I don't know, half of the Western Hemisphere to just get there. Anyway. All right, should we do the thing? We'll do the outro. I'll go. Shall I throw to you and do you want to plug something or something?